All right, so welcome. Good evening. All right, so we're continuing this series, year-long series on the Paramis, this month moving into wisdom. So Lyndall spoke last week about wisdom, and I'll offer a talk today and in 2 weeks. So wisdom is really part of the core part of our tradition. Really, it's what everything boils down to, is this cultivation of wisdom, this deepening of wisdom. And so it's a central part of our practices. You can almost look at every practice we do, everything we do, designed to help cultivate this quality of wisdom through direct seeing, through direct knowing, through developing a steadiness of attention, compassion and attention. Allows us to start to see life in a different way, and in that seeing, wisdom starts to arise. So we can see almost everything does arise from wisdom. The Brahma-viharas, the other paramis of generosity, of virtue, of renunciation, have wisdom as ideally their director, as what really brings them forth. And in turn, as we practice with that, it deepens wisdom. Now wisdom, however, there's some significant pitfalls around wisdom that I'd like to start exploring. Basically, with wisdom, we have to look at this tendency of the mind to want to acquire things, to acquire and solidify, codify information, claim ownership to wisdom, right? So we might have a deep realization while we're practicing. And in that moment of seeing, it just has that, it's very pure wisdom. But we often go back and kind of start to ruminate over it and start to make this a philosophy or a concept that we start to carry through. We try to apply that to life, but it's really reaching back to our past experience. Or we read a book or listen to a talk, and there's some aspect that touches us. But we have to be careful that the mind tends to want to create these shortcuts, these kind of these shorthands. It's helpful because we don't have to keep relearning everything, but it also has the effect of deadening us to the aliveness of this moment. So this tendency to create, to own, to create ownership of our experience. It's really this solidification that we need to be careful of or be aware of. So what I mean by solidification is when we start to carry it as this belief system that we go through life from. So we're no longer relating from the wisdom itself, but the beliefs around it, the concepts around it become what we relate from. It's like we take a snapshot of a person. So in that one moment of time, there's this experience, this expression, this character that was captured. And we put that on our mantle, and then we start to relate to that person from that one moment of time versus the changing reality of that person. And so we start to carry this around, I'm a wise person, or I'm not a wise person, you're not a wise person, or you are. So this process of making a kind of a shortcut or a sense of labeling it, when we first encounter something, we don't have that. We're very much paying attention. We're very present for it. We have a very alive relationship to it. So including as insights arise. So the problem is when we start to use this natural tendency of mind to make our insights into something solid, when life changes, as it will, we create a sense of friction around that, a sense of wanting to make life fit our idea of what's wise versus actually being showing up for what's really present in that moment. You particularly notice this when someone else has a different definition of what's wise. And you're like, well, you know, talk to someone who doesn't meditate or from a different tradition or a different teacher, and you get this battle of fixed views that causes so much suffering. You can see how many religious wars there have been around differences in wisdom. And our tradition's not immune from it. I remember in my teacher training, Jack Kornfield was telling us about in Asia, you would have these different monasteries that were set up around a particular teacher. And unfortunately, more often than you would like to hear, one teacher would be criticizing another monastery, like, that guy doesn't know what he's doing. Only I know. And so there's these kind of this infighting and this battling that seems so familiar to our lives, you know, to our own minds, how we compare and contrast. But this is all in the name of wisdom. So what's happened is there's been some deep understanding, but then the mind has taken that and made it very solid, for like an opinion that we carry through life. And in doing so, we've departed from true wisdom. So I encourage us to approach wisdom not as something that we can acquire, that we can kind of take home and package and say, this is who I am, I'm a wise person, that person's wise. But really, wisdom is something that's an alive relationship to what's arising in each moment. Right? So it doesn't matter how deep your understanding is, it's how is that showing up in this moment. This is an important thing. Sometimes we may have very, very deep experiences with practice, and we keep relating back to that experience instead of really, how does that inform this moment? How does it inform what's really happening here? How am I relating to this moment? That's where the wisdom comes in. So it's not about clinging or fixing around views, ideas, experiences, sense of identity. So we become much more fluid and very much, very intimate with this changing manifestation of life. So we're only as wise as we're able to show up in this experience, in this situation, in this circumstance. So someone may be very wise in much of their life, but there's particular areas that come up, and then their ignorance, their difficulty, their resistance, their reactivity arises with that. And that's their cutting edge of that. Same too with our own lives. We have moments of being very wise, very attuned, and other moments of, you know, very much opposite. To paraphrase Forrest Gump, wise is as wise does. Yeah, wise is as wise does. And so you start to see the tie-in with the first three paramis. If wisdom is really how we meet the moment, how we actually show up for the moment, then there's this choice. We can go toward more suffering, or more the freedom of suffering, and more toward ignorance, or more toward wisdom. So every time there's a chance to offer generosity, to express generosity, that's a moment of wisdom that can be manifest, a moment of virtue, of a sense of safety, of integrity, the moment of renunciation. So it's like not like we acquire these and we just have them forever. There's this constant having to reaffirm that. The good news is that the more we do that, the more it becomes ingrained. It becomes more and more our natural state, our natural tendency. We naturally start to go toward wisdom versus ignorance. So you get a sense that this is really an alive relationship. Each moment is a chance of how do I meet this with wisdom, with the deepest wisdom that I can. You can hold that as a question. When something arises, okay, how is wisdom informed this? How does wisdom come forth? However you understand that. And then pay attention to how it goes from there. Often when you act from a wise place, things tend to be more harmonious, more in tune. Sometimes when you act from a place of ignorance or from delusion, of greed or hatred, there's more friction that comes with that. There's more residue that literally continues on, colors the next moment, the next experience. And while we're able to come with wisdom, that colors the next moment too. So there's a certain momentum that we start to develop. If you start to pay attention, you see how the past often holds us in a certain prison, you know, much including our wisdom. On retreats, often a brand new student who's never been on a retreat before they're very fresh to that relationship, to that experience of being on retreat. They don't know what to expect. They're very much alive. They're practicing. Difficulties arise. Joys arise. They're both meeting that very balanced. Now, someone who's been on retreat for maybe even once, and if they had a great experience, you know, they come in expecting that to happen again. Or someone who's been practicing for many retreats, there's this way they lean into the moment being a certain way. The retreat needs to be a certain way. And often there's a tremendous amount of suffering that happens that, as a teacher, we have to work through with them when they expect the retreat to be different than it is. Right? So this is an example of something that happens all the time, every day in our lives, that we have this expectation of how life will be. Right? So in that moment, the expectation, we're going not from a place of wisdom, but a place of expectation. So it doesn't matter how deep the arising of wisdom was in the past. It's how is it arising in this moment? How is it informing this moment, this very moment, this very experience? Luckily, daily life offers us many opportunities to see where we are with that. You know, we can see where our edge is around our wisdom, around our compassion. And how is wisdom arising when you're behind a deadline at work? How does it show up when you're stuck in traffic and you're late for an appointment? When you're in an argument with a fight with your significant other? When you're feeling pain in the body, anger, fear? These are really the shows us, if you look at it in the right way, shows us really this cutting edge of how wisdom is arising, or that quality of ignorance. And how do we act from that? So with sincere practice, with the natural maturation of our practice, there's this more and more of accumulation that we naturally tend toward wisdom. We do that because we realize we suffer less. We cause less suffering for ourselves and others when we act from a wise place. It becomes more and more important to listen to that. Often for me, it's a kind of that still, quiet voice inside that just knows that sense of resonance, a sense of alignment. Well, when I'm not acting from a wise place, it's very noisy. I'm having to justify it and kind of debate about what's the right action. You know, there's a point of confusion. But when I'm able to catch into that wisdom, there's a place, yes, this is the right way to go. And in that, there's also a settling. You know, it doesn't mean it's maybe an easy choice. It may be a difficult conversation, a difficult thing to have to do, but there's a sense of alignment with that. So as we practice, it's really the whole tools of meditative techniques are designed to start to cultivate this wisdom, this ability to discern for yourself what's wise and what's unwise. And this grows and deepens. You know, from the very first day we meditate, that's transformed after the many years of practice. So wisdom. If you look at the suttas, there's often this particular phrase that comes up that we can see as in some ways a core statement of wisdom. The statement is, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So the Buddha would use this as a point of reflection, a point of inquiry, especially when someone's really stuck in a place of view. This particular sutta on Majjhima 8, I believe it was, this one monk comes to the Buddha basically complaining about people who had these fixed views, especially about their own practices. So the Buddha responds in this way. Because when we get really fixed in it, the tricky thing about wisdom I was trying to convey is that we take it as being true. And in that taking it as being true, we don't see that we've also solidified in a belief around it. We solidified a sense of self behind that. So reflecting on these three, these aspects, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself, starts to loosen that positionality. Because it's impossible to hold a fixed opinion. It's impossible to hold a fixed opinion if you don't hold a fixed sense of self. They basically they're conflated. They arise together. When I have a fixity of opinion, of view, I'm also fixed in who I am in that moment, in that relationship to that experience. So that in that exploring that whole process is a central part of our practice deepening. This is the essential aspect. So it calls forth a direct seeing in this moment. How is this, where am I taking ownership? What am I conceiving as being wise, you know, versus the actual embodiment of that? The actual embodiment has at its heart emptiness. There's not this core sense of me being wise. It's just naturally flowing through. So these three statements, this is not mine. This points to this pervasive ownership that we place on things, on life. This is my thought, my emotion, my bodily pain. There's a sense of relating to it. This is my wife, my daughter, my job, my role. So this is not the same as I'm not taking responsibility. There's kind of a nuance here that we have to navigate, because it's very important for us to take full responsibility for our actions, for our way of being in the world. But in that responsibility, we see it also as not being inherently a statement of who we are. You know, so we take care of the damages we cause, the hurts we cause. We speak up when we need to speak up. And it's transformed because it's held in a quality of emptiness. This I am not. So this sense of identity, this deep sense of who we take ourselves to be, how we define ourselves and how others define ourselves. I mean, each one of us, we have, you know, our kind of our personal definition of who we are, shaped by our family, by our culture, by the society. We have, you know, you've probably all experienced this, some more than others, that when you don't fit in with the main category of people, there's a way that you kind of, you're really kind of trapped or held in their opinions. You know, and that can sometimes just be this subtle weight that you feel. Sometimes it can be very violent, very, very destructive. This sense of identity that we use to conform who we are and on everyone else. And then this is not myself. They're even further driving this point home. This is not myself. That question, like, you know, where am I? Who am I in this moment? I mean, whole spiritual teachers, Nisargadatta, use that question very extensively. Who am I? Ramada Mahasi, his teacher. Often it's interesting just as you're sitting to say, okay, where am I located in this moment? You know, where am I really located? Where is this sense of self located? As you hold that question more and more, you start to see that there's not a substantial place of that. As you start to observe yourself over time, in the midst of a day, even in the midst of a sitting, even in the midst of a few minutes, there's different senses of you that arise, and then another one arises. This is because things are conditioned. That sense of self is arising out of conditionality instead of being a solid thing. Now, it's interesting with this claiming ownership, because it's proportional, directly proportional to how much suffering we experience. So in other words, the more we take ownership into something, the more suffering is kind of inherent in it. But also the amount of suffering we experience also shows the potential wisdom that can come from that. I mean, some of the most difficult experiences in my life have led to some of the deepest wisdom. Because it's the kind of experiences that you just can't get around, that they're just all-consuming. As you really open to those and really start to release the argument with them, start to really feel them, start to feel the deeper beliefs that are triggered by them. In that process, you start to have a deeper quality of wisdom that arises. In this tradition, there's some lovely examples of this. There's a nun, I forget her name, but she was one of the chief nuns in the Buddha's time. So before she was nun, she kind of eloped, ran away with this man she wasn't supposed to marry, you know, so she kind of broke away from her family. So there's the pain of that separation. So she broke away, went to live, and they had a child, and that child died, and they had another child. And then finally she wanted to go back and visit her family. And they went on a trip there, and it was a rainstorm. Her husband was killed. Right? So there's the grief from that. And then later she tried to go by herself with her two children, a toddler and an infant. And she had to cross this river, and she left her toddler on one side and carried her baby across and put her baby down. And she's walking back in the middle of the river, and an eagle comes down and grabs her toddler. Right? And she's, you know, screaming, and her toddler hears that and comes in and gets swept away. So in a very short time, she's lost her husband and her two children. And she goes back to, you know, see her family. And then she asks someone, you know, where's my family? And they said, don't ask me that. And she asked again. And it turned out they had been also killed by the storm. So in this very short period of time, she lost everyone dear to her. And, you know, basically she went out of her mind and wandered in a very, very painful state. And the Buddha saw her and said, recover your mind. Recover your mind. And in that moment, she was able to come back. But that root of steep suffering paradoxically led to deep wisdom to arise. And even in our modern time, Dipa Ma had a very similar story of grief, of losing her children, losing her husband. And she went finally to a meditation retreat center, had her literally crawl up the stairs because she was so overcome with grief. But when she started practicing, she had a very deep attainment in a very short period. So there's a ripeness that came from that suffering. Outside of this tradition, but still within it, I would argue, Eckhart Tolle was very depressed for most of his life until he had this big awakening. Byron Katie, a deep depression. She was unable to leave her room, attend to her family, until the suffering led to an awakening. See, in these cases, the pain of identification, the pain of taking ownership became so great, the only way out was to release that, ownership, that identification. And in that release, there's a great wisdom that arises. So these three... This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. But it sure feels like this is mine. This is me. This is who I am. You know, it's like we have a convention of talking about that. It's like we feel like something's happening. And so there's a deep honesty and sincerity that's really needed in this practice to see where are we taking ownership? Where are we really identifying? So not to kind of jump over our pain body, as Eckhart Tolle would talk about, our sense of difficulty, the parts of us we don't like. You know, get over this sense of painful self to go non-self is not the direct way to go. Where am I claiming ownership? Where am I saying, this is mine, this I am, this is myself? So that becomes a very... As you attune to that question, you know, who am I, or this is not mine, however you want to phrase it, whatever brings you alive, also notice when that's not in resonance. When there's a sense of, yeah, this is really who I am. I'm really attached to this. And really, working around thoughts is one of the key ways to open this up. Because thoughts become this key way of creating identity. Because we believe our thoughts. We believe our thoughts as being true. We believe our thoughts mean something about us and others. And that's one of the fundamental things as a meditator we try to learn, is that our thoughts aren't inherently true. That our thoughts are not inherently true. They're just something that's been triggered and is arising. Right? So we may see that in a very simple way, just noticing as we meditate how many thoughts go through our head. We start to see, okay, this is this radio craziness going through our head nonstop. But we start to be able to observe it and not realize it, and realize it's not who we are. And we just carry that process in deeper and deeper ways to the sense of, you know, who I take myself to be, all those different manifestations often triggered by deeper pain. See, thoughts, this sense of where I am, there's this often a fallback position that we come in. When push comes to shove, where we tend to go back, when we say, okay, this is really who I am. When we're feeling good and comfortable, when we've slept well, and, you know, everyone's nice to us, it's easy to be wise. But, you know, when we're tired, when our kids are being obnoxious, and when, you know, our boss is yelling at us and things are difficult, that's really the edge. Where do we default to? So I hope that to encourage a sense of curiosity. It's hard when things are not going well, but to step back and really investigate that position that you fall back into. Because that position you fall back to is some of the deepest levels of identification, what we really truly believe. And being able to touch into that much deeper belief system is so critical to allow things to open up. As you start to touch into it, you see that, okay, this is just a thought. Okay, so all thoughts are inherently empty. Or you can say all thoughts are equal. So you see a thought arises, you start to relate to thought as just, okay, this is just what's arising in the moment, whether it's a thought about I want to have this for dinner or a quality of this deep belief. It's an equal quality of manifestation. So we start to see where we identify, where we claim ownership. And this shows us our edge of wisdom. How is wisdom really showing up in this moment or not? And we just keep investigating until that is seen through. So much patience is needed, much perseverance to keep meeting this experience. Now this is not about disassociation or a sense of distancing from our experience, from who we are. If we look really clearly, we see even that sense of disassociation or a sense of distancing is often driven by subtle thoughts. Thoughts we say, this is how I should be or how I shouldn't be. You know, we see more clearly, okay, I'm more identified with the thoughts about me being less than versus more than, or however it might show up. So learning to work with our sense of self and its wounding is also very critical. What I mean by wounding is that we start off as young children, you know, as infants, there's not a sense of self. There's no differentiation between the infant and the mother. They're one thing. And developmentally, that child needs to start to learn there is a separation, there's a distance, there's a distinction between that child, her, and her mother. Okay, by doing that, that's a healthy developmental piece. Because many of us have had different dings, different things happen in that process, our sense of self doesn't get so solid, so intact. Whether it's abuse, neglect, trauma, they hurt that developing sense of self. So we often come to the practice with this somewhat of I want to say dented or quite, you know, a little bit of an injured sense of self. So much of the work of practice is learning how to have a healthy relationship to that, a sense of being okay at ease with the sense of self, some measure of peace with who we are. And so being patient with that. You know, sometimes it takes a long time to be able to feel that sense of, okay, I really belong here. I have a right to be here in this body, in this place. Yeah, so much recovery work is around that. And once that feels stable, then the next stage is to start to question that, to start to look at that more closely, to see, okay, is this really the whole picture? Right? And so then we come back into that releasing of self, and we be able to see that there's connection, there's interconnection. And Christina Feldman often talks about the navigational self and the whatever the other self is. So the navigational self is the self that knows what to do, you know, how to navigate our lives, our relationships, our roles. Right? The other sense of self is more this deep identity. So we don't lose that ability to navigate through life. We just release the constriction that causes so much suffering, where we take ownership. As Byron Katie, the work she does is, who would you be without your story? Who would you be without your story? Kind of an aside with Byron Katie. When I heard this, I realized it challenged some of my beliefs about who comes into spiritual practice. Right? And really notice when you have those little challenges, when you say, oh, I kind of had a different expectation. That shows you where you identify. It's a point of seeing the process of fixing things. So when she was here in Seattle, a friend of mine went and talked about Trump, her relationship to Trump. And she was very surprised how many Trump supporters came up to her after, who were in the audience, who are followers of Brian Katie, and find her work very helpful. So just as you hear that, you might notice, maybe you are a Trump supporter, but just notice that how there's a sense of dissonance, perhaps. That, oh, you know, someone who's a Trump supporter can't be spiritual, can't be interested in growth, and really seeing the illusion of thought. So, what is this massive stuff in our life, if it's not me? And if it's not who I am, if it's not mine, if it's not of me, what is it? You know, why does it, because it seems like there is something going on, right? Something's happening here. So what the Buddha often said is everything arises because of conditions. Right? Everything arises because of conditions. Everything passes away because of conditions. And the self, the sense of identification, is really an add-on to that. So like this last week for spring break, I was able to go down to Yosemite and went for a hike on Saturday. So we started off the hike and it was sunny. And we got up to the waterfall and saw the beautiful rainbow. And then a little bit later, it started to hail. Okay, and a little bit later, it started to snow. Right, it snowed for a couple hours. And then later that day, it was sunny again. Right, so we look at that changing weather, and we say, okay, well, this is conditions, the temperature, the moisture, the air particles, the way the mountains shape the weather, that led to those different changing experiences. And this is the same thing happens in every thought, every emotion, every experience, that it's shaped by our conditions. But the difference is, instead of me saying, okay, and now I'm a rainy day, or now I'm a snowy day, I'm not taking ownership of that. I'm not saying that's who I am. Right? But it's the same process. We're no different than nature. So as you hold these questions or these statements, this is not who I am, this is not of me, this is not myself. As you hold that question, when something like a painful emotion arises or any thought, anything that arises in your experience, just say, okay, this is not who I am, this is not who I am. As you do that, you may start to notice how that emotion, that thought, is really arising because of conditions. Sometimes it can be a very pervasive condition of your life, some root from childhood that keeps coming forth. It could be just seeing a movie. It could be anything that can come up. But that each moment's experience is really conditioned. It's empty of an inherent sense of you. So yet we add on, okay, this is beyond the sense of this is me, this is who I am. And then that adding on, that becomes the root of our suffering. That becomes the root of our suffering. That sets us up for this ownership, which sets us up for the suffering that we're trying to be free of. So this thought, this reaction, this body, you know, our choices and our actions do influence, they shape the conditionality of it. But so much of it, the particular manifestation, is really outside of our control. Yes, so something's still happening, but we don't have to assign a sense of ownership to it, a sense of self to it. So when you do this, there's a sense of the emotion just flowing through you, the thought, the feeling. It flows through us. It's not who we are. In some ways, it becomes more intense, because when we label it and identify it, we kind of modulate it. But if we allow it to flow through, it lasts. It doesn't leave residue. It doesn't stick. It just arises and passes away. So you start to become more a participant in life instead of always fixing it. So again, moment by moment, that's where wisdom shows up or doesn't show up. A phenomenal way to work with this is the sense of, okay, where am I taking ownership? This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. This investigation into the nature of self, you know, may or may not resonate with you. You know, it was something that was very, and continues to be very interesting for me, something that I very much get excited about, really want to understand. Because I do see that as self arises, suffering arises with it. As self fades, the suffering fades with that. Rodney used to call me a dog with a bone, because I would be just like trying to gnaw this question. And so that sense of interest has to come from you. You know, and so for some of us, like, oh, that's just a nice concept. Others, it may be something that, okay, well, I'm kind of curious about. Others, it may be this burning passion. And as it burns more and more, then that inclines yourself to look more and more deeply. In that deep looking, you start to see, okay, where does the self arise? As you start to see the illusion of the self, when you see the emptiness of that, when it falls away, then, okay, that becomes this point of wisdom that we can start to shape how we relate to life. You know, again, we have to be careful not to make that a concept that we impose upon it, but more as this arises, how can I see the emptiness in the moment, the emptiness of me in that arising? And as you do this, be forewarned, you start to see more and more at the places that you identify. The most painful parts, the most painful aspects start to show themselves. Right? But as you practice with that, and you start to really work with something that's very meaningful in a painful way, and you eventually see that, okay, this is just a thought that can be dropped away, tremendous confidence starts to come up. Okay, that I can meet more and more of those. So in this way, wisdom cultivates more and more wisdom. All right, let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. So whatever experience is arising in this moment, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Thank you for your kind attention. So I'd like to just say a few words about the practice and reflection for this week. So approach wisdom not as acquiring or possessing some trait or quality. So just to notice, you know, do I think of wisdom as being something that I kind of take on as ownership, or is it more an alive relationship to each moment? And start to shift your thinking around that. See that wisdom exists in relation to how each moment is met. So a moment arises, is there a way of relating to it from a wise place? And practice meaning all aspects of thought with, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Just kind of play with that. You know, every thought that arises, you know, this is not mine. This is not who I am. And feel free to kind of tweak those, that language. This is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. And you can tweak it so it maybe fits better. This is not me. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Now, as you do that, you find there's places that you that doesn't resonate with. There's a sense of, okay, this really does feel like who I am. You know, this is all that other stuff. This is really me. Keep working with that. Notice the shape of it. How does that sense of you show up? How does it manifest? Be very patient. See it without an agenda. If you see it without an agenda, you often see that there's a part of it that you really didn't realize. Like I was working with this last week and just kind of feeling, I'm trying to navigate how to say it without revealing circumstances just because I don't want to. Let's just say I was feeling kind of sorry for myself around this situation. And then as I worked with it, it's like, there's actually an arrogance around that. And when I saw that arrogance, because I don't like to think of myself as an arrogant person, but when I saw that, that's the sticky point. That's the sticky wicket, as they say. When I saw that, then the whole thing released, at least to some extent. And that, and not seeing that deeper belief behind the more superficial one, that kind of kept the whole thing going. You know, something I've been working with for a year now. But just seeing that more clearly was very helpful. So being patient with that. You know, this is a long, long process. And as you, other thoughts that arise, when you do see that this is not me, when you really resonate with that, you let that also inform the moment. Use that bit of wisdom to inform how you meet other moments. So it becomes more of a North Star that, okay, this is the right alignment. So you cultivate that quiet, still voice inside. All right, we have a chance for any comments or questions about the talk or practice or anything. Yes, Raleigh. So the question is about thought. And when I talk about thought, do I also referring to emotions at the same time? You know, I tend to separate them out. Certainly, there can be a thought without much emotive quality to it, but there can be a thought. There can be emotion that usually has some thought with it. So I tend to see emotion as being this combination of thought, body sensation, belief. There's the whole hormonal thing that's going through the body. So it's this big, big lock, you know, lock of things. And so it's very helpful to start to separate those out a little bit. Because if you really watch an emotion, let's say you have someone who you care about kind of frowns at you. Right? So then you make this story, this person is unhappy with me. That story then creates the fear around it or the anger around that. That creates more thought, or creates more emotion, and it just keeps going on and on and on. Right? And so just the thought and emotion are almost like they kind of activate each other, like a epoxy. You take these two things together and you put them together and they just get this big sticky mess. And so learning to kind of separate that out. That's why in meditation instructions, it's very helpful to keep orienting to where's the emotion felt in the body. Because the thought is so sticky, it's so alluring. We go into the thought, it creates more and more thinking, more and more emotionality. Connecting with the body's sense of it actually initially becomes more intense because you're feeling it unmitigated. But in that process, you're slowing down the overall chain reaction. Does that make sense? Yeah. So thought I would use very, very broadly, from a sense of, you know, a thought like we could write it out, to even the sense of seeing something and knowing, okay, this is Romilly. That sense of identification is also a form of thought. To the sense of perspective of me seeing you, or a sense of distance. It's all subtle ways of thoughts that manifest. Yes. Yeah, nice. Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful. Yes, beautiful. So just to share that with, if you couldn't hear that, she knows that when there's a sense of taking ownership for a thought, there's also, or since this is who I am, there's also a sense of this is what you are. So they actually arise together. And that's a really important thing to see, and I really appreciate that seeing of that, because it's very true that that's how we hold ourselves in prison and everyone else in prison. And it's like there's this constant, this thing. And this is why we have such a predicament. That's why it's so hard to be a human being. It's because we're constantly, our self is kind of getting triggered and being forming. And at the same time, we're putting that on someone else, and they're doing the same thing to us. And, you know, I can't imagine how many, arguments I've gotten into with my wife that when we really talk things through, we realize we had a completely different experience of that. You know, it might be pretty, you know, the details, the actual what happened maybe, but the way we're relating to it, how my history came into that moment, how her history came into the moment, and what the meaning we assigned to that. And as we liberate ourselves, we also liberate the world. Remember Christina talking about that? It's like we're really liberating the world from our minds. And that's a beautiful way to keep, to hold that. And that brings so much energy to practice, because you realize it's not just about me. It's really that sense of the whole world. And you notice that too as you meet life without needing to make a self somewhere outside. Instead of doing that, you're actually really meeting that person, who they are in that moment. And that's a beautiful gift. So, you know, that compassion, because it will show you, if you're really sensitive to it, you will see the deepest pain in yourself, that sense of, okay, being arrogant and not wanting to be arrogant, that sense of self-judgment. And you realize, okay, I have this, and everyone else does too. And then suddenly there's a softness that you go through life. There's a deep compassion with this common predicament that we all walk through. Thank you. Yes, Susan.
Sometimes I have an aversion toward a person and I look for that which I'm averse to in myself. But I'm wanting to look at that deeper in terms of what is the opposite, like something I'm not letting go of.
Yeah.
You mentioned the arrogance, or I can see where there may be lack of compassion, but there's something else operating. I'm not sure I am.
Yeah, so the question, if I got that right, is that there, when you often see a sense of this external judgment, you try to look at where that is, what you're judging about yourself, for example, and then how do you actually get to the deeper seeing of that? You know, what's really the deeper belief or hook is that?
Or that you mentioned your example of seeing an arrogance in
yeah.
your sorrow or what you were experiencing, and I'm looking at what is the goodie? Why do I keep repeating that?
Right. Yeah. So what is the payoff for keeping repeating that pattern? So one comment is we have to be perhaps guard a little bit about being too sophisticated with things. Because sometimes when we kind of, okay, I'm going to figure out all this, it kind of takes us away from the direct experience. So this is, it's not an abstract thing. It's really, you know, it takes time. It takes a certain spaciousness. What I mean by spaciousness, like a chance to really go inside uninterrupted, whether you're sitting on the cushion. I like to go for a walk in the park. At times there's not many people. It's been some of my most fruitful practicing is just to really walk with this pattern. And so for myself, what I often do is just, okay, let's really feel this. Let's feel this as fully as I can, as deeply as I can, without as little friction, release as much friction as I can around it. So, you know, just feeling the deep pain around it. And as I do that, sometimes there is it allows the scene to be more clear. I often use this analogy, like, let's say this pin is this difficult experience. And when I'm kind of looking at it with a little sense of judgment while I'm seeing it, I only see the one face of it. But I really embrace it, I can start to feel all the way around it. When I no longer hold it away from me. And so then, oh, there's this whole side I didn't realize of arrogance. Okay, wow. And sometimes you see the deeper roots of that. So that's one way to work with it. You know, Byron Katie has some nice, I mean, she directs some very questions like kind of turning it around. Like let's say, that person, like is there like a, can you give me a brief statement of what it is if you want to? I don't want to put you on the spot.
No, but what I see is a lie more about something I think is ugly in myself.
So a lie about what you see is... So you're taking what someone else is doing and saying, okay, this is something that's resonating with me, that it reveals a belief about myself. I think, that's true. But you might play with that. Okay, the other person's, you know, saying something that's really triggering. Let's say they're saying a lie. So play with, okay, maybe what they're saying is true. Maybe it absolutely makes sense to me. So you kind of play with reversing it. You often find there's a particular statement that you're using. Then just flip it to the opposite of what that is. And in doing that, you can say, oh, you know, that's uncomfortably true, or that's that kind of, you get a sense of that? Like this person is always lying, they're never telling the truth. Okay, let me just hold this question, maybe they are telling the truth. And as you do that, oh, you know, then you see where your view is. So being playful with it is also helpful to kind of just see, ask it in a different way, ask the question in a different way. Because you often find there's a particular statement that you've kind of boiled down to, this is really what the issue is. And you just kind of change the verb to the opposite, change the subject to include the other person or to include yourself. Yeah. Yeah, it can be, you know, it can be daunting, it can be painful, and yet when you start to really see the end of it, see through it, then it's actually very interesting. And then it starts to fuel looking more and more deeply because you see, oh, each of these instances actually show me where I'm stuck, where I'm identified. And the heart wants to be free of that identification. So it actually becomes very joyful work, even though it's hard. I was just bowing to her, but... Anyone else have anything to share? Yes.
It seems like emotions are often used to trigger action, especially difficult action.
Yes.
And we often kind of stoke the fire of emotion to get us ready to take that action. Mm. And I wonder what it looks like to motivate action through wisdom instead of through emotion. Mm.
So the comment is that we often use emotion to help motivate or bring the energy behind difficult actions. And what does action look like when it's fueled by wisdom instead of by emotion? Yeah, it's a good question because often much of our action when we look at it is really reactivity. You know, we've gone triggered, we're upset, we've got to do something about something. And the practice gives this gift of being able to be responsive instead of being reactive. And for myself, there's often a sense of holding the perspective much bigger, you know, much more inclusive. When I'm caught by emotions and I'm really acting for my emotions, it's like I get these blinders on. It's like, you know, it's very clear, like it's this way or that way. I'm right and you're wrong. And any reasonable person would agree with me, that kind of a thing, right? And it's just, I gotta do all this to kind of stand up for myself, right? And so wisdom says, okay, this is my perspective. Really, you know, like the whole saying, walk a mile in another person's shoes. You really start to see, okay, where's their perspective coming from? Really deeply listening to that. And in that sense of this is one aspect of the wisdom, is including that person's motivation, their needs, their hopes, their fears, all those qualities. So that's one aspect. Wisdom also has a very fierce quality to it also, because there's this sense of, okay, wisdom really knows when things are lined up, when there's ethics are very clear, when there's a sense of this is a harmful action, this is a hurtful action. And so it can still be very powerful, but it doesn't have that sense of being so worked up. And so it's actually received much more clearly. You know, there's been times I've been upset and I'm trying to say something, but I'm so charged by it, you know, my voice is shaking and I can't quite do it. There's other times it's like, no, that's just not okay. That's not acceptable. And it just, you draw the line very clearly and the boundary is very much established. You don't have to argue about it. When it's coming from emotion, you have to convince the other person because you're not quite convinced yourself. Yeah, so it feels like you're really solid, you know, on solid ground. It may still be a difficult experience, a difficult thing to do, but you know that you don't have to justify anything. You know that you're coming from a clear place. So there's some aspects of when wisdom is really directing our actions. There's also a kind of a cleanness, there's a lack of residue when things are really coming from wisdom. When they're really colored by emotion, you're kind of rehashing it and thinking about it. It's like, okay, it wasn't quite clear there. But when it's clear, it's like, okay, this is what I have to say. And that person receives it or doesn't receive it. You may have to do some follow-up, but you don't have to carry it so much with you. Because wisdom is really coming from that sense of emptiness. It's almost like a compassionate emptiness. Thank you for that. It's a good question. Yes.
I have a question about, I'm just a little confused about, I guess I'll explain it this way. I feel like I spend a lot of my day at work in my thoughts and out of my body. Mm-hmm. And I find quite a bit of relief from then relaxing my body, especially focusing on the breath. Beyond my physical ailments, but and so I don't quite understand how
So the comment is on spending much of her day in thought, and coming into the body is a beautiful respite. It's like I feel very grounded from that and calm from that. And how is releasing the donor ownership with the body, which feels like the only place of really home, how does that lead to freedom from thought? Is that so? This is one of those it's a process, and it's like having that place of really arriving and being connected to your body. That's often the most appropriate thing to do when thought is so diverse and so caught up. It's like when things, what I'm trying to say is that in the middle of life, it's very helpful to be able to have that touch point of the body, coming back into the body. And actually by releasing thought, that's what's needed there. You're just releasing thought and coming into the actual moment's experience. And as that becomes, with the conditions of your life or through practice, starts to become more and more the natural resting place, then you can start to see, okay, how is there a sense of identification with that? So what I'm trying to say is we don't want to throw out this as a skillful means of connecting with the body. And yet there's also the sense of orientation that, okay, I am at home in my body. So if I'm at home in my body, by definition, sometimes I'm not at home when I'm in my thoughts. And so I've set up a duality, a dichotomy in that. So as I come, so as I start to investigate that, okay, where really is, what is home, where is I in this? And you start to realize, okay, as the body becomes less defined, becomes more this process that you're able to participate in, by doing that, you start to soften the belief in home, in I being at home. And in doing that, it starts to undercut the thought process too. Because, you know, thought arises, there's a sense of you that arises with that. By working with the body, again, you know, this is not something that you may be able to do in the midst of a busy work day. It may be more, you know, longer practice periods or more of a quiet time in your life to come back into that. But you start to see, okay, this body is not where I reside. You start to see I don't reside anywhere in these other thoughts. And doing that, then the thoughts arise, but they don't have this hook back into who we take ourselves to be. Do you get a sense of that? So the physical body, it's like, again, there's a relative and absolute truth. So the relative truth is like, yeah, you know, this is my body. It's not anyone else's body. The absolute part is that is really the belief in it being a. Let's see, what's a way to say this? There's a shift from it being the whole story to being just part of the story. You know, similar to if you just had this one perspective and you kind of maintaining that, and then finally for some reason you open up and listen to someone else's perspective, very different than yours, saw it as being valid, it's like you have a much bigger view on life. So when you go through this kind of narrow sense, this is who I am, this is the whole story, we limit ourselves from the interconnection of life. So we start to open that up and we say, okay, something arises, it doesn't have such a sticky point. It doesn't create so much suffering. At the same time, there's a much bigger sense of interconnection. You're welcome. Yeah. But, you know, keep coming back to the body. I mean, it's important not to push things faster than they naturally want to go. Like just coming into the body is a refuge. You could spend a long time just coming back more and more to the body. So the body becomes this natural place of refuge, natural place of orientation. This is where I'm located. It's like that same thing. We have to learn how to locate where we are, to be centered, before we can release that center. Yeah, so just be patient with that. Use that as long as you need to. Yeah, because she was, you know, basically crazy. She is psychotic at that point.
How did the instructor psychotic?
Well, I think, trying to think back to this story. I mean, basically, it was just a direct, you know, connection. He was able to just really connect with where she was and call her attention back. You know, again, the psychosis sometimes has its own momentum. And you know, there's a lucidity and not. So I wouldn't read too much into what, we don't know exactly what was going on with her and, you know, how that whole thing happened. But the Buddha had a very profound presence. You know, and to really connect with this person when she was probably being shunned by everyone else, and it became that point of stability. And you get a taste of that when someone's really upset, when you really pay attention to them. It could be a complete stranger. Someone going through a checkout line or someone in line, you say, "Wow, what's going on?" When you really connect with them, there's a point, you get stable from that. It stabilizes you because the person's connecting from a point of stability, and then that helps to stabilize yourself. So I think that is what happened with that story. You're welcome. All right, maybe one more question if there's one out there or comment. Okay, so the homework or practice of reflection is back there for your use. And this one is, this can be one you can work with for years. And I wrote on it this week, and I said, okay, get rid of that line because it's really something that you can work with. You know, for many manifestations, become more and more curious. How does thought show up?